This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and Mr. Taylor, whose writings on the industry you can regularly read over on The Wrap, and whose musings on the Mission Impossible movies you can now listen to on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. He and I are recording this week's show on Sunday, October 8th, and 20 years ago today, Mickey's PhilharMagic opened at the Magic Kingdom in Florida. And you must have seen this East Coast or the West Coast iteration, the one that DCA that opened in 2019.
Yeah, I haven't seen the DCA one yet. But yeah, I remember when it was new and it was very fun and charming. So I'm excited to dig into that on the second half of today's show.
All right. But of course, before we do that, there's the news portion. And as always, the news portion of today's show is brought to you by Fine Tuning's new sponsor, which is Touring Plan's own travel agency. And if you're thinking of visiting the Walt Disney World Resort down in Florida or the Disneyland Resort out in California, these obviously knowledgeable folks can help you plan your dream vacation. They'll even toss in a subscription to Touring Plan's for free. So if you're thinking of leaving the house to go meet with the mouse, the first stop on that journey really needs to be this website, touringplans.com/travel. Jumping into the news now, and we typically start by talking about the box office. And number one at the box office this weekend is Exorcist the Believer. And did you see that?
Yeah, I saw it. I really enjoyed it. I was a little mystified by the negative reviews, because I had a great time watching it. Yeah.
Okay. So that made $27 million domestic. Supposed to be the first film of a new trilogy. Is that right?
Correct. They've already dated the next one, which is called The Exorcist Deceiver, which is April 18th, I believe, 2025. You know, just that, just the thing you want to watch over the Easter holiday, you know?
Okay. And there have been a lot of Exorcist sequels and prequels. I mean, the first was The Heretic back in June of 77. And then there was The Exorcist 3 that was actually directed by William Peter Blatty, the guy who wrote the original novel.
Yeah.
And the screenplay for the first Exorcist film. And then there were prequels, but there was sort of a frenzy back in June of 2021 when the rights for making a new trilogy became available, right?
Yeah, I mean, it ended up being a deal that Universal and Blumhouse put down for $400 million to make these three movies. And it seems like a lot. It was definitely a licensing thing, but you know, at the time that the deal was made, it was the height of, you know, the streaming frenzy, and they were snapping up rights to all these high profile things. Mm-hmm. We were still in the middle of the pandemic, and it seemed like a good idea at the time, probably. I will also say that, you know, they've already started to monetize this property. If you've been to Halloween Horror Nights on the East or West Coast, you have been through the Exorcist Believer maze. There's merchandise being sold at the parks in relationship to this movie. So people that are like, you know, saying the sky is falling because it didn't crack $30 million opening weekend, you just need to settle down. It's going to have a long run through October. In fact, I believe that it'll probably be available on PVOD before Halloween even rolls around. And then obviously it'll have a much longer life on Peacock and various Universal-owned outlets, you know, the AMC Fear Fests of the future years and all that. So
I don't think you're wrong. And in fact, the point you just brought up about it not breaking 30 over its opening weekend, I mean, the very fact that they brought in this film for just $30 million production cost-wise. And also, the other thing that's kind of fascinating about this is I think the what comforted the folks at Universal and Peacock was Warner's opened its books. And Exorcist, back when it was first released to theaters in 73, ultimately was the highest grossing film for that year. And then went on for a time, at least in the 70s, was the highest grossing film at Warner Brothers. In fact, it was kind of a tough pill for the studio management to take, because prior to that, their highest grossing film had been My Fair Lady. So it's like, oh, yeah, Rex Harrison, you know, Audrey Hepburn, high class, you know, as opposed to pea soup spewing, you know, Linda Blair.
Did you see that the movie opened 50 years to the day of the original? 50 years to the day.
That's pretty crazy. But anyway, Warner's opened the books and pointed out that, by the way, over the past 50 years, between the multiple re-releases and that sort of thing, we've made $440 million off of this thing. So, you know, the whole notion of, well, you paid $400, but look what they made long-term. So it's like, this seems like a safe bet. But that's, again, now to pivot to the animation news of the day. I mean, again, this is kind of the entertainment world we live in these days. The safe bet. And case in point, Paw Patrol, the Mighty Movie, which is a sequel to Paw Patrol, the movie, which in turn is based on the Paw Patrol animated series, which debuted on Nickelodeon back in August of 2013. It's the second weekend in release for this animated feature, which, by the way, is in 4,027 theaters, which is 38 more than last week, Drew. They actually upped the number of theaters it was out in, and more to the point, it's in more than 350 theaters more than The Exorcist Believer. And you know Paw Patrol, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of this week, there's nobody in the theaters to see that. That does all of its business matinees. Maybe the evening show, but, you know, there's no 10 o'clock crowd for Paw Patrol, the Mighty Movie.
Yeah. I think it's going to get a little boost from Columbus Day / Indigenous Peoples Day this week.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
And I think that actually Yom Kippur might have given it a little boost, too, during the week. But, yeah, it's a solid franchise at this point, right?
And toward that end, I think the thing that fascinated me is that Blumhouse, you know, gets Exorcist Believer out the door for $30 million. That's actually supposedly the same price point that Paw Patrol, the Mighty Movie, was delivered to Paramount Pictures and Nickelodeon Movies for. And when you consider that the original film, the first Paw Patrol movie, was out in theaters summer of 2021 and then went on to gross $144 million worth of tickets worldwide. And it's backed by a solid retail program and, you know, so it's no surprise whatsoever. What fascinated me is the day before Paw Patrol, the Mighty Movie, opens in theaters, they announced that, oh, by the way, we've got a third Paw Patrol movie in development, and that's going to hit theaters in 2026. So this is just the way corporate Hollywood works these days. Which brings us to our next story. What's going on at DreamWorks? We'd been hearing over the past week or so that there had been layoffs at DreamWorks Animation, but it was a handful of people here, a handful of folks there. And in fact, Drew, I think you were mentioning you heard people being let go from promotion, that sort of thing, or?
Yeah, marketing and, yeah. I mean, not huge numbers.
Okay.
But anyway, what Jim is referring to is a much larger story that was published on Cartoon Brew on Friday.
Yep.
And basically saying that the studio is going to stop producing films fully in-house at the Glendale campus that they've worked out. And, like, it's really interesting, the breakdown of time. You know, they'll do 60 minutes and another studio will do 20 minutes. And it's really interesting in that regard. But, yeah, what did you think when you heard this news, Jim?
Just on last week's show, you were talking about Chris Sanders' new project for them, The Wild Robot. I had no idea Wild Robot is supposed to come out next year from DreamWorks. In fact, they haven't pinned down an exact release date yet, but it's supposed to be late fall, early winter 2024. Is that what you're hearing? Or
Yes, that's what I mean. Okay. Yeah, they wouldn't let me put the date in my my piece, but it's going to be if Kung Fu Panda is the Ruby Gilman of next year, then yes, Wild Robot is going to be the Trolls of next year in terms of release dates. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, speaking of Ruby Gilman, just today the Amazon truck came rolling up the driveway because it turns out our other Target hasn't quite gotten rid of its video section, but when I was in there the other day, they only had the DVD. So it was like, I really need the Blu-ray and the digital version. So ordered that off of Amazon, and you know, we'll look forward to finally seeing the extra features and all that later tonight or thereabouts. But it's next year that we get Kung Fu Panda 4 in March, and then at a date to be named later, we get The Wild Robot, Chris Sanders' next project for DreamWorks. And then there's a project that's only being done for streaming, Orion in the Dark. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's Miknos, I believe, did that, who did the animation for Captain Underpants, as well as Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem. That looks really beautiful. And yeah, that'll okay. be a Netflix project next year. That's sort of outside of DreamWorks feature animation. It's technically a TV animation project. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Okay.
But anyway.
Okay. But then from that point forward, we have these new mixed production models, which, as you mentioned, footage being done in Glendale, so much footage being done elsewhere. And what was kind of interesting in the middle of that is they announced an unannounced sequel, which, are we allowed to say the S word here, or? Really? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I can't say what it is.
Okay. We're going to leave
but
that.
Anyway, yeah.
We're going to leave that there. Okay. Now, the irony is, you know, you were just mentioning about incidental cuts and marketing and that sort of thing, but there's another DreamWorks film headed out the door, Trolls Band Together, which hits, you know, theaters early next month, November 3rd. And you got to feed the beast. You got to get your film into the spotlight, however you can do that. And so did you see the stuff coming out of the Dallas-Fort Worth airport earlier this week where the...
No, what happened in the Dallas-Fort Worth airport?
Well, you know, folks arrived to get on their Southwest flight, and they were greeted at the gate by walk-around versions of Poppy and Branch, who then would take people over to the window and point excitedly at the plane they were about to get on that had its custom Trolls Band Together paint job on the side of the thing.
Oh, very interesting.
This quartet of images that Southwest PR team, you know, pushed them out the door. And one of them was the folks posing at the gate with the Poppy and Branch walk-around. And then when you got on the plane, you were handed a swag bag, and inside of it was a Trolls wig. And so they have this picture of the interior of the plane with multicolored wigs going all the way back. And the folks on the plane were then treated to free, you know, they could watch the original Trolls from 2016 or the Trolls World Tour from 2020. Then they pushed out to the effect of, oh, by the way, if you weren't on the flight, we still have sweepstakes that we're doing, that chance round trip air to travel to LA to see, I think it's attending the Trolls Band Together world premiere. And meanwhile, in other ways, DreamWorks Animation is going great guns. I mean, I don't know if you've seen any of the photos that have been taken over the wall of the change out of that corner of Universal Studios Florida, how it's now being turned into DreamWorks land?
No, I haven't seen it.
They're doing an amazing job building a film accurate replica of Shrek's house from the swamp and the old Woody Woodpecker Nuthouse coaster has been left in place, but they're in the process of repainting it and retheming it. And that's going to be the Troller Coaster, Drew.
Can't wait. Cannot wait. Well, I was telling you before we started that the Trolls are also being seen outside of the Sphere in Las Vegas. It's the first advertisement for any movie. And there's some custom animation of the Trolls on that giant sphere. We should talk about the Sphere more on a later show, because, you know, ILM did all the animation for the U2 thing.
Everything I've seen so far, between what they can do on the exterior of that building, but it's the interior stuff. I mean, did you see any of the footage that people took at the YouTube concert?
Yeah, the ILM did all that stuff. They did all the animation, which was just, I mean, that stuff where it looks like the ceiling is coming down on you. I mean,
it
is insane. Absolutely insane.
The notion that you would pay the amount of money that, you know, you have to pay to go to a YouTube concert. And almost after the fact, oh yeah, Bono on stage, I should be looking at that.
I've heard that there is a little bit of that sensation during the show.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. It seems very cool. I mean, what they've done in there is just amazing. And also, U2 owns all that imagery. So they can actually take that and do other shows, I guess, in a traditional arena setting with all that ILM animation. It's very interesting, but especially because there's some section that's like there's many sections actually that are very Las Vegas specific, but I don't know.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
yeah. If anyone wants to Venmo us $500 each, we will go go watch the show.
Yes, we'd be happy to go and report back. So
yes.
But anyway, we were just talking about the Universal theme parks, and we've got Chicken Run, A Dawn of the Nugget. In fact, I think you were mentioning that the London premiere is next week or thereabouts?
It's on the 14th, yeah.
On the 14th,
so,
okay.
Yeah, I have to watch it still. I have it. I'm dying to see it. It looks just so cool. There was a great presentation at Annecy last year, or earlier this year. God, Jim, I don't even know. What year is it, Jim? I've woken up from a...
2023 is a lot like that. In fact, yes. I cannot understand how is it October? It was February 5 minutes ago. This year has flown. But anyway, we talk about the Universal Parks, and the original Chicken Run had, I think, maybe one of the shortest lived exhibits at a theme park. This would have been a twofer for you, Drew, because what they did is they took the Marvel Mania restaurant after it closed, and they changed that into the Chicken Run maze, which had, you know, and as you made your way through the maze, they had, you know, like a giant Mrs. Tweety looking down at you in rubber vegetables that you interacted with. And
oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, but again, only lasted 5 months. It was there June of 2000. It had to close by November, early November, so they could put Grinchmas in there.
And the whole thing smelled like Dr. Doom chicken fingers.
Yes, the tabbouleh salad themed around a villain. Okay. By the way, back to the promotion of Dawn of the Nugget. Sam Fell, who was talking with Deadline, had an event over in London called The Contenders. And they asked him about, well, all right, 23 years. Why did it take 23 years to do the sequel? And Sam said the quiet part out loud, which I love, kind of to the effect of, well, at the end of the first one, you're kind of a bit sick of chickens. It took 3 or 4 years to make this thing, so everyone wanted to do new things. And animated sequels weren't a big thing back then. I mean, yeah, there had been Rescuers Down Under in 1990, the follow-up to 1977's Rescuers. And arguably, Toy Story 2 was probably the first real big successful animated sequel?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand this Feifel Goes West erasure, but you know, I guess we could deal with that.
Put a pin in that one. We're going back to that one.
Okay.
But anyway, Ed Aardman, they kept, you know, it's like, that was a hit. We should do something with that. And they were brainstorming sessions, and the first Chicken Run was so good, you didn't want to follow up with a bad idea. And so jump forward to 2016, and Fell runs into the co-director of the original film, Peter Lorre, who says, we've got it. We figured it out. He said the trick of solving the story problem was, you know, one line. And it was like, this time they're breaking in. So suddenly it was a whole different story. It was a heist movie. To circle back to Toy Story for a sec. So I remember When the first Toy Story came out in 1995, they talked about it. One of the things that made it different was it was an animated buddy movie.
It was an animated buddy movie for the first time, and then Pixar would have animated buddy movies for the next 30 years.
You're not wrong. All right, but if we look at, we jump ahead to Toy Story 2 in 1999, during the publicity for that, they talked about, hey, we switched up the genre. This is now, it's a heist film. You know, Woody's been kidnapped, and in order to rescue him, they have to break into Al's apartment. But you were pointing out that they switch up the genre yet again with Toy Story 3, right?
Yeah, Toy Story 3 is like the like a prison break movie.
Yeah.
With even some horror elements in there, which you would not expect in a Toy Story movie, but then think, oh yes, this is Lee Unkrich, the man who is obsessed with The Shining. So, of course, they're... Of course, there is a mysterious, ghostly telephone call telling Woody that they'll never escape. You know, yeah. It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. But then to jump ahead to Toy Story 4, which I think you and I both agree, I have no idea what, you know, genre that film is.
It's more of a romance, really, than anything else, ultimately.
I can see that.
I love Toy Story 4, but yeah, it is a lot of things
it is going a lot on of things. In there.
Yeah.
I'm willing to forgive any movie if it sticks the landing, and that moment with Woody and Buzz on the roof of the camper where she'll be fine. It's like, Bonnie will be fine. And just literally, you know, setting Woody free. That, for me, redeems the whole movie. It's like all of the shakiness of the story at that point, it just, they stuck the landing. It's kind of the same way I feel about Meet the Robinsons, where... Lots of shakiness, but that landing, that ending, beautiful, beautiful stuff. And speaking of which, that's Steve Anderson. Have we heard anything about his book yet, the Florida book?
No. The In-Between Years? Yeah, I haven't heard anything. Let me see.
Just want to remind folks, that's out there somewhere, and you know, hopefully it will finally make it to bookstore shelves, and very, very, very much looking forward to that. Anyway, in the world's worst transition now here, folks, we're going to be talking about Mickey's PhilharMagic on the second half of today's show, which had no Pixar in it till the Coco update in 2021, right?
Mm-hmm. I never saw that. Did you see it yet?
Okay.
I haven't. No, is it cool?
Do you remember when they ran that clip for Coco at D23, where it was kind of the shoebox edition of the movie. And they made a very big deal about this. It's Pixar's first musical and had all of these Dia de los Muertos characters, you know, coming at the screen and singing and swapping heads and that sort of thing. The new scene in Mickey's PhilharMagic is they basically resurrected that. That scene, which, again...
Oh, interesting.
Never made it into the movie, but got resurrected in a kind of a limited form for Mickey's PhilharMagic. So it's worth checking out for just that. But we will talk more about that on the second half of today's show. But first, this, folks. We were just talking about Coco. And something very cool involving this Lee Unkrich movie is about to come over the horizon. And Mr. Taylor, can you please talk about that?
Well, it's actually out. I think there are still copies out there. But if you track down the Mondo version of the vinyl record for the soundtrack, there is liner notes in there by myself. I wrote them and I talked to Lee Unkrich about this original version of Coco, which is very interesting. And why that version didn't work out, and all sorts of great stuff about the soundtrack.
This is fascinating to me because this is Bobby Lopez and his bride, Kirsten Anderson Lopez, who, wasn't this originally supposed to be like a Pixar's first musical with like 8 or so numbers, right?
Well, what the original story was that the family hated music, and then when they were sent to the afterlife, they could only communicate via song. So there were tons of songs, and you know, traditional songs plus the songs that were written for the movie, but it just ended up being too complicated. But that was the story that dictated so many songs for the movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
How many of these are included with the Mondo?
None of the songs are included with them, but we talk about it in the liner notes. So that's the silver lining. Yeah, we talk about this version, but yeah, there were no. I don't know what kind of clearances that would require.
Wow! Oh, that's great! Holy cow! Well, I got to get this just for the liner notes.
Yeah,
that's a great story. Okay. Yeah. Pivoting now to hopefully an equally entertaining story, and we're here to talk about Mickey's PhilharMagic, which in a weird sort of way is kind of a sequel to the show that originally went into the Fantasyland Theater at the Magic Kingdom, and that was the Mickey Mouse Revue. And given my advanced age, I actually saw this during its relatively short run at the Magic Kingdom. It opened October 1st, 1971, but was closed September of 1980. I don't think you were actually alive then, Drew. Were you?
I was not alive, but I did listen to the Retro WDW podcast recently, and it seems like it was removed because Tokyo Disney wanted it, and they could not physically turn another version around, so they just ripped it out.
You're not wrong. When they showed the paper model version of this to Roy Disney back in the mid to late 60s, after Walt died, I mean, Roy was like, this is what we should be doing for Walt Disney World. This is what Walt would have wanted. We have to do this show. But you're right. They needed things for Tokyo Disneyland. And, you know, the thinking was, okay, they really want this. We'll just take it. And more to the point, they'd already been have you ever heard the famous stories about the capacity issues for this show?
Yes, that it never actually played to a full house because
yes,
the theater was like 500 seats, but you could only fit 300 people.
There we go. No, right? That's it exactly. From day one, it was behind the eight ball. You know, just the operational people. It's like, you're not meeting your numbers. It's like, I can't meet your numbers. I don't have the physical room in the lobby. What moron designed this theater? And so now, mind you, it sits empty for 7 years. And eventually, Captain EO opens in 1986. And when it opens in 86, it actually bumps Magic Journeys out of its home over
in... That's right.
And so this empty theater, which again showed an animatronic show up to that point, they set up a screen, and now it's showing Magic Journeys. You know, and it does that for multiple years until it then shuts down in December of 93. And that's when they put in the Legend of the Lion King show. And Len and I were just talking about this on the Disney Dish we did earlier this week, talking about this is back when Disney would do that. I mean, the Lion King opens in theaters in the 21st or the 24th of June in 1994. And by July 8th, or so less than 2 weeks, there's an attraction in the park that celebrates that film that's still out in theaters.
It's that Michael Eisner magic right there.
Well, there we go. I mean, you know, that's what you had to do. But there had been this feeling within Imagineering to the effect of, you know, we ripped out the Mickey Mouse Revue and Roy said, you know, this is the thing we should be doing. And it's like, okay, can we circle back around to that idea? And then it was the whole notion of, well, yeah, but we don't want to do anything with that many animatronics. It's a maintenance nightmare. And how about a film that does what the Mickey Mouse Revue did? So it became this interesting collaboration between Walt Disney Imagineering and the animation studio. And George Scribner became the de facto director of the project. And a decision was made that this was not going to be hand-drawn. This was going to be CG. This is during that period where, you know, hand-drawn is on fumes at Disney. And so, but at the same time, they wanted these CG characters that they were going to be pulling from The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast and The Little Mermaid to look like they did in the hand-drawn film. So they did things like they reached out to Nick Ranieri, who had done Lumiere for Beauty and the Beast, and Nick came in and did Lumiere for the film, for Mickey's PhilharMagic. a lot of the folks who worked on this weren't necessarily happy because of that. You know, in fact, there were a lot of complaints back in the day that when they finally sort of settled on the design of the CG characters for Mickey's PhilharMagic, it was sort of like, we're doing a Rankin Bass special here. I mean, they don't look very lifelike. But Glenn Keane came back and handled the animation of Ariel in the Part of Your World number for Mickey's PhilharMagic. And this had a profound change on Mr. Keane's career. How much do you know about the early work on Tangled?
Well, I know that he really wanted this kind of painterly look, which we are finally getting with Wish, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But that they really just struggled with the story. I mean, there were sort of like, you know, quasi Shrek-ish, you know, versions. There was a one that was partially set in modern day San Francisco.
There we go. In fact, I just found a story breakdown for the version set in San Francisco. And here's how it goes. An evil witch named Lucretia despised fairy tale happy endings and plotted to change all that. And meanwhile, in modern-day San Francisco, Claire and Vince are two vastly opposite teenagers who cannot stand one another. Claire is a short-haired, fashion-obsessed teen who's concerned about her looks, where Vince is a stocky and crude pizza delivery boy who's on hard times. And the two of them get on each other's nerves, which gets the attention of Lucretia in the fairy tale realm. And do you remember this beat from the story? Supposedly there was a storybook on the wall or on a shelf that as Claire and Vince are fighting, it falls off and Lucretia rises up out of the book. If you can see the way Drew is holding his head right now, he loves this story.
Well, no, I remember the Vince character was like modeled after Jack Black, I remember.
Wasn't he supposed to actually voice the character?
Oh, was he? Yeah. I mean, you look at the drawings and it is total Jack Black.
Total Jack Black. And I want to say that this is also the version where it's Reese Witherspoon who is supposed to have voiced Claire. Okay, Lucretia comes out of the fairy tale realm. She takes Rapunzel and her prince beau and transforms them into a squirrel and a dog. And
yes.
And then Claire and Vince are forced into these two roles. Claire is now Rapunzel and Vince is now the knight that's supposed to get her out of her tower. And then Claire and Vince eventually team up with Rapunzel and Beau to defeat Lucretia and to return to their respective places in time. And even Keane supposedly admitted, well, this is kind of the Shrek version of that story. So Glenn, I guess, had originally had the idea for a Rapunzel movie in 1996, pitched it to Disney, and they were like, that's really nice. We have this Tarzan thing we'd like you to work on. And so he goes off to Paris and does Tarzan. He pitches Rapunzel again, and they're like, that's really nice. And tell you what, if you finish working on Treasure Planet, the Long John Silver character, we'll let you direct it. And so he finishes that. That comes out Thanksgiving of 2002. And then this is Glenn at Disney, and he gets tapped to, hey, before you start on that, can you go over and help the Mickey's PhilharMagic people with Ariel? And he comes away with this, oh my God, you know, the potential, what we could potentially do with animation with CG. I mean, and he tries to win over a lot of the folks at the studio. In fact, there's this fascinating period in 2005 where Glenn holds a series of seminars at the company called The Best of Both Worlds. The thing that Drew was referring to earlier about the painterly take of CG, you know, he kept showing, it was the Fognar, the swing image.
This, yeah.
There we go. Yeah. That they had this classic painting that they had turned into CG. And it's like, we can do this with a movie. And that was, I think, the toughest part of the history of Rapunzel. Because everyone at Feature Animation at Disney respected Glenn Keane. I mean, you know, a 30-year veteran of the company, you know, so many of the great classic characters. So they gave him a lot of rope And the thing was, they would see these amazing chunks of test animation, and it's like, that looks amazing. But the story is crap. And they could not get a handle on what Rapunzel's story was. And then nobody actually ever said Glenn had a heart attack. He had a cardiac episode, and that he had to step away from the production. And that was when the two new directors of Rapunzel stepped in, and, you know, Glenn stayed on as an artistic consultant.
Yes, but all of that, you know, you're going to be able to see the brushstrokes in the background. Mm-hmm. All of that went away.
It did. It did. On the other hand, I would argue, I still personally believe that Rapunzel 2010, and no disrespect, you know, Frozen's made a lot of money, and you know, our pal Josh Gad, you know, voiced Olaf. But I would argue Rapunzel's the better movie. It hasn't turned into quite the film franchise that Frozen has, but I would argue Rapunzel's a better movie.
No, but in an odd twist of fate, it inspired a long-running 2D show that has some of the best 2D hybrid animation that I've ever seen from Mercury Filmworks, our friends up north.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Absolutely beautiful.
One of the things that Glenn did to sort of sell people on what was possible, and in fact, the people who went to his Best of Both Worlds seminar remember that Glenn would pull out this CG ballerina that he created. And, you know, it was like, wow, that is amazing. And then come June of 2012, Glenn decides to leave Disney and sort of, you know, forms his own company, Glenn Keen Productions. And the first thing that kind of put him on the map was Duet, the thing about the little boy and the ballerina. And we've since seen a lot of amazing work from Glenn, who clearly is doing some innovative stuff involving CG. And is there any talk yet of a follow-up feature? Because I know Over the Moon, you know, Netflix seemed very pleased with how that went.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything. I mean, he worked on that show with his son, the one about the
truck.
Truck.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't seen Glenn. I saw his daughter recently, but didn't get a chance to sort of ask what Glenn was up to. So yeah, yeah, I'm assuming he's, you know, he's creating, he's working on something, hopefully. You know, I mean, he's a master for sure. And yeah, I thought Over the Moon was great. So I would love to see another.
Yeah, same thing here. But the thing that turned Glenn's career in an entirely different direction was Mickey's PhilharMagic, you know, being asked to come in and do, and I want to say the Mickey's PhilharMagic is only 12 minutes long, and I want to say the Part of Your World number in it, I don't think it actually runs a full minute, but it was that, you know, working on that model and looking at, wow, this has that potential. From the get-go, interviewing folks when Mickey's PhilharMagic first opened back in, you know, October 8th, 2003. And it was like, oh, you know, what's great about this is, you know, we can do new numbers. We can bring things in. And over the years, you know, there had been talk about swapping out, you know, for example, doing the lantern scene from Rapunzel, because the thing is, oh, that would be gorgeous in 3D, or to do Let It Go and to have, you know, Elsa conjuring ice in 3D, you know, hanging out over the audience. But it took till 2019 for them to finally admit, okay, yeah, we are going to do this. We're finally going to put in a new number. But it's not from any of those films. It's from Coco. And, you know, it was largely because people within the company remembered that amazing shoebox number to the effect of what Lee put together to sell the film to Pixar, and how it was all these characters coming at you in 3D and dancing down a really narrow street and singing directly into the camera. And it's like, that's too good just to sit in the vault. I mean, it's kind of like the story of Baby Moana, how that footage of her interacting with the wave and collecting the shells, that was only done as an in-house test. And people were like, this is too good. This has to be in the movie. And, you know, they reworked the story to put it in. And this Coco number that's now in Mickey's PhilharMagic, was just a test for the real musical version of Coco, which wound up getting cut back to just two songs. Is that how many are?
I think there are three songs.
Okay.
Yeah, I was at Disney during the lead up to Moana, mm-hmm. and I saw that thing so many times. The test of her, the baby. But then you would see as they started integrating it into the movie that it would change, and like there would be story elements added. And I'm sure that consumer products thought, wait a minute, we could sell baby Moana toys.
They could.
Let's see if we can get that in there.
They could. So kind of a fascinating story how the parks influenced the movies as opposed to the movies influenced the parks. But speaking of movies, the day that this show goes live online, October 10th, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 becomes available on digital. And I would imagine that you and Charles Hood over on your wonderful Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, they're doing something fun to commemorate that.
We are in the midst of our Eddie Hamilton three-part episodes. But yeah, I think we're going to do a special episode on the special features because they are really, really good.
Cool.
So buy it, go through the special features, and then in a couple of weeks, you can listen to our breakdown of all the fun stuff.
In order to know when these things go live, again, I got to ask about social media, you know, where are you? What are you doing?
I'm still on Twitter or X or whatever, even though like this thing with the not putting up the title of the articles is really just a pain.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible over there, but I'm still there.
Okay.
Glutton for punishment, I guess. But
yeah.
Yeah, Drew Taylored on every platform, including Blue Sky and Threads, although I don't think I've done one on either.
Okay.
Drew Taylored, T-A-I-L-O-R-E-D, like a tailored shirt. Mm-hmm. And then Jim at Jim Hill Media on?
Well, what is it? Twitter X, also Instagram. And Nancy also has us on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. We do have a couple of other podcasts here we'd like you to check out. We got Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. We have Marvelous Disney, which I do with Aaron Adams. And he, in turn, has his own outside project, 32nd Street, which shines a spotlight on Madison Avenue. Later today, in fact, I will be recording a brand new Looking at Lucasfilm with Brian Gunn. We're going to talk about the last episode of Ahsoka. And by the way, Drew, you were not wrong. That was very entertaining. We just made our debut on Patreon this past weekend. Disney Unpacked, our video series that Len and I did with veteran Imagineer Jim Shule, just went live. You can get a taste of that on the Disney Unpacked YouTube channel, but if you want to help and support and subscribe that, if you want to head over to Patreon. Let's see. Beyond that, if you could do Drew and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just the show you're listening to right now, Fine Tuning, but also Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. And I think that's going to do it for this week. Anyway, on behalf of Mr. Taylor, thank you for listening to this week's Fine Tuning, and we will be back soon.